I'm going to go ahead and introduce our presenter. I'm sure some of you remember David from last year when he did an ethics training for us, and we received a lot of positive feedback, so I asked him to come back. David is an attorney in the 13th Circuit with CLS. He actually works for the Attorney General down there. And he's been a managing attorney at CLS and has held a number of different positions there. And he's been there, I think, since graduated from law school. David can correct me if I'm wrong, but I know he's been working in child welfare for a long time. And he was recently the chair of the Juvenile Rules Committee. So with that, I'm going to hand it over to David. I don't know the hypo, David and he enjoyed writing it, and I enjoyed proofing it. I don't know what that says about our personalities, but we hope that you enjoy this training. With that, I'm going to hand it over to David.
All right. Well, thanks a lot, Mary Kay. I had a really great time conducting the ethics training for y'all before. I know that we're going to have a great session. It seemed like last time there were a couple ringers in the group that came up with all the right answers, and I'm sure that y'all are going to do that again today. The guardian ad litem, I just want you all to know when you read the scenario, and Mary Kay wrote me an email and said, hey, our guardian ad litem attorneys really like this and the scenario, and of course not. First, I'd like to thank all of you. The guardian ad litem attorneys are critical in the process, are a big help to me, have been through the years. I've been doing this work for 16 years, and whenever there's a guardian ad litem on the case and a guardian ad litem attorney, I am just overjoyed because it is so much help having another person on the case to assist and to work for the best interest of the child. Also, I'd like to recognize you all also for your training resources. One thing that I tell attorneys here when they need CLE credit is, well, have you gone on the guardian ad litem website? And just like the training today, y'all have excellent training program with a lot of different interesting subjects that are recorded. And I always tell our attorneys to listen to the great programs. And also your training manuals, case law summaries, I mean, awesome. Couldn't be better. I am, in fact, envious of all the great materials that you have for training. Just to start out with, I'd like to just explain the difference, because I sent you all some excerpts from the ethics rules, and you also have the guardian ad litem standards of conduct for attorneys and standards for the program. And there's a difference between ethics and professionalism. And we're going to be talking about both. Now, this is an ethics training. We're going to also be talking about professionalism. Now, remember that ethics is, what are the minimum standards of conduct for an attorney? But we're interested in that, in ethics and ethical rules. But what we're really interested in is professionalism. And that is the highest standard of conduct for attorneys. So when we go through this scenario and go through the issues, we're going to be touching not only on ethics, but also professionalism and y'all's standard of conduct. So I hope that y'all have opened your standard of conduct and your rules and take a look at them during the training. I'm sure most of you probably all know it all by heart and don't really need to refer to it. But even in putting together this training, it is really helpful reviewing the rules and reviewing the standard of conduct, because you always learn something new. Also, what we're going to do is we're going to read through the scenario together and then review the issues and rules and what the guardian ad litem attorney could have done differently. And also, we have an attorney ad litem in the scenario, and we have a DCF attorney, so we can talk about their roles, too. I do have one disclaimer, and that is what I started out with. I don't want you all to get an impression, because I put a scenario together that has an attorney not doing the best work, that I have seen that here in Hillsborough County with the guardian ad litem attorneys, or through my practice. I spent 10 years in the Fifth Circuit with DCF when I was managing attorney there. So I don't want you to think that, you know, the guardian ad litem attorneys that I've come in contact with are anything less than professional, because all the guardian ad litem attorneys that I've had contact with in my practice have been extremely professional and, like I said, a really big help. Basically, I put the scenario together to get us to discuss issues. And yes, in my 16 years, I have run across attorneys, not guardian ad litem attorneys, but attorneys have certain ethical issues. So one thing that we all want to gain from this training is a review of the rules, a review of what our minimum standard of conduct is, understand what ethical issues we face daily in our practice, and how we can act to avoid any ethical problems in the future. And I had a special request by a guardian ad litem attorney that I have worked with for a while, and she asked that I not mention her name, and that is Phyllis Ho from Hillsborough County, wonderful attorney. Excellent attorney. She asked that I not mention her name. That is Phyllis Ho. Oh, did I just mention her? Okay. Sorry, Phyllis. I just mentioned your name four times. I got you. Okay. Throughout our training today, we're going to move fairly quickly. Please take your phone off mute if you want to make a comment. And the purpose of this training is for you to participate. So please feel free to turn your phone off mute. But like I have done in the past, I'm talking and talking and talking, and then I'm like, oh, I got my phone on mute. So let me take my phone off mute. So just pay attention to that. All right. Well, to get started with this scenario, we have all the players, and we have Sally Henson, the child, Martin Lowry, another child, Rita Smith, the mother, Tony Hill, the attorney for the mother, Ronald Henson, father, Sally, Wanda Rodriguez, the attorney for Ronald, Sandy DeWeese, the DCF attorney, Gina Davis, the CBC caseworker, Mike Lowry, the father of Martin, Luke Waters, the attorney for Mike, Lori Hill, the guardian ad litem, Audrey Johnson, the guardian ad litem attorney, Henry Lee, the attorney ad litem, Judge Swanson, the dependency judge, and Bill Owens, another CBC caseworker. We'll just read through the scenario all together quickly. On September 1st, 2009, DCF sheltered Sally Henson, age 7, and her brother Martin Lowry, age 13, due to the failure of Rita Smith and Ronald Henson to protect Sally from physical abuse from Martin. The investigator found that Martin hit Sally in the head with a baseball bat, causing Sally to suffer from a concussion. Both Rita and Ronald saw Martin pick up the baseball bat and threaten to hit Sally with it. Neither parent intervened to prevent Martin from hitting Sally with the bat. In fact, both Rita and Ronald were intoxicated and laughed when Martin hit Sally with the bat. In addition, the DCF investigation revealed that Ronald engaged in domestic violence against Rita. Rita advised the investigator that on August 30th, 2009, Ronald came home drunk and tried to strangle her in the presence of Sally and Martin. Rita indicated that this was her first incident of domestic violence with Ronald. The investigator did not find any evidence that the children were harmed physically or emotionally due to the domestic violence incident. Rita further told the investigator that Mike Lowry beat her in the presence of the children when they lived together 4 years earlier. She said that Mike had not had contact with Martin in 3 years and had not paid child support for her for Martin because Mike does not believe that he's the father of Martin. She stated that she was never married to Mike and he was not listed as the father on the birth certificate. She never contacted the Department of Revenue to assist her in obtaining child support for Mike. Judge Swanson held the shelter hearing on September 2, 2009, based on the allegations of the shelter petition. The judge sheltered the children. All the parents appeared at the hearing. The judge appointed attorneys for the parents, and the judge further appointed a guardian ad litem program and an attorney ad litem represent both children. Sandy DeWeese, the DCF attorney, never raised the issue that Mike was only a prospective father and not the legal father. To protect Sally, the children were placed in two separate shelter homes. It became quite apparent that Martin had very bad behaviors, hyperactive, disrespectful to the shelter parent, violent towards the shelter parent, and the three younger children in the shelter home. However, Martin's conduct was not bad enough that he required involuntary placement in a mental health facility. The caseworker, Gina Davis, had Martin evaluated by a psychiatrist. Psychiatrist recommended that Martin take Adderall for his diagnosis of ADHD. Rita and Mike refused to consent to the psychotropic medication. Sandy sent the GAL program Martin's psychiatric evaluation and medical report pursuant to statute 39407. Audrey Johnson, GAL attorney, called Sandy, stated GAL cannot consent to the medication for Martin until the GAL completed a consultation with the University of Florida Medline. The earliest appointment for the Medline consultation was mid-November. Sandy prepared and filed a motion for court authorization to provide Adderall to Martin and noticed the motion for the arraignment hearing. Lori Hill, the guardian ad litem, called Audrey and said Martin should have his medication as soon as possible because the shelter parent was unable to control Martin's behavior. Audrey told Lori that the guardian ad litem program was unable to consent to the medication even though it appeared that the medication was warranted. Lori was clearly dissatisfied and said, "You are my attorney. You are supposed to do what I tell you to do." Audrey tried to explain the guardian ad litem program policy to Lori. Lori continued to state that the policy was senseless. Eventually, Audrey hung up the phone on Lori in frustration. So, we'll stop there. This conversation between Lori and Audrey, does anyone have any ethical issues that they want to bring up? Okay. You have to take your phone off mute in order to participate. All right, well, it looks like I got a bunch of shy guardian ad litem attorneys on the call. So we'll start out with Lori is the client, right? She's telling her attorney what she wants her attorney to do, and her attorney's not doing it. What's the ethical problem there? Who is your client? Anybody want to answer?
The child. This is Tom Hampton, the 16th.
Okay. So you're indicating that the client is the child. Okay. Well, if that's true, then is the attorney following the objectives and representing the child by saying, no, we got to do this consult first before this kid can get medication to help his behavior problems.
Let me correct myself. Actually, the client would be the program.
Right.
Itself.
Okay, so doesn't your program standards indicate that the guardian ad litem program is defined as all individuals employed by and volunteering for the guardian ad litem program?
Yes.
So here's someone that's volunteering or employed by the guardian ad litem program, and they're telling Audrey what to do, and she's not doing it. So, I ask, who's the client? Remember, 4-1.2, objectives and scope of representation, that the lawyer shall abide by the client's decisions concerning the objectives of representation and shall reasonably consult with the client as to the means of obtaining the objective. So, again, I ask, who is the client and what is Audrey ethically obligated to do?
Audrey has to weigh what the client, when I'm saying the program or the coordinator or the volunteer is the client. and she has to weigh what the coordinator slash volunteer is requesting versus what is available by law. And what's, and there lies the reasonable aspect of that, if, you know, if they can find the way to the means.
Okay, but the issue here is that both the guardian attorney and the guardian ad litem both work for the program, right?
Correct.
So what you have is you got a guardian ad litem program policy that differs from the opinion of one of the members of the program. So how do you resolve that?
I'll take it to the circuit director.
Okay. Well, that's good. And then you also have to look at Rule 4-1.13, the organization as a client, that the lawyer has to proceed in the best interest of the organization. And you're correct, because within that particular rule, it tells the attorney that if the attorney wants to resolve issues where there's a conflict or the representative of the client, the program, wants to do something that is against the interest of the organization, that it needs to be elevated to a higher authority. But that is very good that you would do that. What about Audrey hanging up on Lori? Is there an ethical prohibition of hanging up on someone, your client or the representative of the client?
No.
So someone's saying no? Does anyone think yes? Okay, well, surprisingly enough, I mean, there is an ethical rule regarding communication with the client, and that is Rule 4-1.4, but it doesn't specifically say that there should that the attorney should not hang up on the client. But it is a duty under Rule 4-1.4 explain the reasoning behind the attorney's decision. It says in A2, it says that the lawyer shall reasonably consult with client about the means by which client's objectives are to be accomplished, and also to keep the client reasonably informed about the status. Now, would you say that Audrey adequately followed the rule regarding communication by hanging up the phone? Come on, help me out here. You guys are the training, I'm not. Okay, well, then I'll be the attorney for Audrey, or her supervisor. What she's going to say is that she already tried to explain to Lori the guardian ad litem program policy, and that Lori just wouldn't get it.
Ethics and professionalism.
What's that? Say that again, please. I don't think that everyone heard you. I know I didn't. So could you say that again? Said something about there being a difference between ethics and professionalism? All right, then I'll just take your comment for what it was. Apparently there was a comment that there is a difference between ethics and professionalism. Now, like I said, what Audrey's supervisor is going to say is to defend Audrey, or Audrey's going to say to her supervisor, look, I tried to explain to the woman what was going on here, and she just wouldn't get it, so she just hung up the phone on her because she couldn't get anywhere with her. Now, there is a difference. Now, ethically, we may not say that Audrey was unethical under Rule 4-1.4, but definitely hanging up on someone is unprofessional. Does anyone not agree with that proposition? And see, because I have so much silence, I know that I'm going to get the right answer.
Hello, this is Charlie from the 6th. If you tell someone that you're going to have to hang up if they, you know, you can't get anywhere, I don't see where that's unethical, but just to slam the phone down would be unethical. But if you're talking to someone and say, well, we're not getting anywhere, I see you're getting upset, you know, perhaps we need to cut short this conversation and finish it at a later time. I see nothing wrong with that.
Good point. And that is, you know, that goes to professionalism. You know, attorneys are supposed to be, you know, polite and respectful at all times. And you try your best. I mean, I remember one time when I was in the Fifth Circuit, one attorney, parent's attorney, was screaming at me over the phone. And eventually I just said, look, I can't communicate with you by screaming, you know, by you screaming at me. So if you don't stop screaming, I'm going to have to hang off the phone. And what do you think she did? She kept it going, and eventually I had to hang up the phone. I didn't slam it down, but I hung it up. And, you know, the thing is that as attorneys, when we're talking about communication, I always say that 99% of the world's problems is due to a failure to communicate or ineffective communication. And typically, the best way that I see, you know, because I'm telling the care managers and the sheriff's CPIs all the time, no, you can't do this. But there's a good bedside manner that you have to use when you do it. And my technique is that I say, you know what? You're concerned that this child needs medication? Well, guess what? I am too. I agree with you. I think this kid needs medication. So let's work together to get it. Unfortunately, we got to work with guardian ad litem program policy to get this Medline consult. So I'm sorry, but we need to go through this. But I'm on your side. So it's all in the way that you couch it and give your legal advice and the way you communicate with people. Because if you approach it in that way, you're like, look, you know, are you unsatisfied, you know, with my opinion? If you are, please get up the chain of command. Talk to my supervisor. It's fine. No problem. And that's how you deal with that situation. Okay. So we've talked enough, I think, about the hang-up situation, and let's not get hung up in the training on the hang-up. Ha-ha. Okay. We'll move on with the scenario. The court conducted the arraignment hearing on September 23rd, 2009. All the parents denied the allegations of the dependency petition. No attorney raised the issue of Mike's paternity status. Sandy raised her motion for authorization to provide psychotropic medication for Martin. The attorneys for the parents stated their objection to the motion. Audrey voiced her objection to the motion by stating the guardian ad litem program policy. Lori attempted to interrupt Audrey, but Audrey said in a voice loud enough for all participants to hear, "Will you please shut up already? I've heard enough of you." Henry Lee, the attorney ad litem, stated, although Martin was against taking the Adderall, it was obvious that after meeting with Martin, that Martin needed the Adderall. The judge denied the motion and indicated that the motion could be reheard after the receipt of the Medline consult. Okay, so we'll stop here. So what ethical issues do we have regarding no one bringing up Mike's paternity status at the arraignment hearing? Anybody? Did the guardian ad litem attorney have an obligation to raise that issue? Yes or no? What do y'all think?
No.
Anybody?
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. Okay, well, since he said yes, I'm going to put you on the spot. Why did the guardian ad litem attorney need to bring that issue up?
Because that's an issue that could have possibly affect permanency.
Right, and it relates to the best interest of the child.
Right.
So what, was it unethical for the attorney, for Audrey, to not say anything?
I don't know if it was, if it's unethical if she didn't know, like, if she didn't know that she was, that this issue existed or that she was supposed to raise it, then I don't know that it's unethical. That's what I think.
Okay. Anyone think differently?
I think under competence, that she is ethically required to be competent and provide competent representation, so she should have known.
Very good. Rule 4-1.1. Glad that you brought that up. It says competence. That the rule says that a lawyer shall provide competent representation to a client. So essentially what happened here is that Audrey was just sitting on the sidelines and letting error occur, because that's essentially what was occurring, as we see later in the proceeding. And someone also brought up the point that not dealing with the paternity issue at the soonest possible time in the proceeding, well, that's not in the child's best interest. What, are we going to get to TPR and then have a paternity issue come up? Or do we want a situation where we get a disposition order that names Mike as the father and no one brought it up, and now we're doing a TPR and we have to deal with him? When originally, if we brought it up earlier in action, maybe we wouldn't have had to deal with him. All that basically delays permanency for children. So very good in bringing up that point. Then, how about the back and forth between Lori and Audrey? Was that unethical for Audrey to say in a voice loud enough for everyone to hear, will you please shut up already? I've heard enough from you. Yes or no?
Unethical.
It's unethical? And what would, what rule or why do you think that it's unethical? I mean, is it violating any confidentiality? Is the attorney demonstrating a conflict of interest? What's going on here?
It would appear they have a conflict plus unprofessional.
Right. It appears that the attorney is not in agreement with Lori that, again, you have 4-1.2 regarding the objectives and scope of representation, that the attorney is failing to argue the client's wishes. And that rule says that the lawyer has to abide by the client's decisions concerning the objectives of representation and shall consult with the client. So what we have here is something going on in court when it should have gone on where? Someone already mentioned it.
In staffing before court.
Right. Should have been with the director of the program. If we're getting to heart of issue, and then also in your standards I saw that there was mention, if something's going to affect the whole program, you need to get the director and the Office of General Counsel involved. And it may not be statewide, a statewide issue, but definitely a local issue, right? Because if the guardian ad litem and the attorney are at odds on this policy and it's going to be brought before the court that they're at odds on this policy, then that's a bad thing. So it needs to, when anything has to do with affecting the program, the director of the program, your managing attorney needs to be brought into the equation. And these conversations, you know, this also deals with competence, you know, 4-1.1, because attorney has to have heads up that an issue is going to come up in court and may blow up and has an obligation to take it up the chain to resolve it. Someone had something they wanted to say?
Yes, this is Charlie from the Sixth Judicial Circuit again.
Yes.
In the standards of operations, in standard 4.6, there is a decision-making process, and it walks us through, you know, who is to be brought on, which team members are to be brought in when there is a disagreement between the GAL and the program attorney. So we do have a process that addresses that issue.
Right.
And that standard 4.6 starts on page 19.
Excellent in pointing that out. Also, remember, you have attorney standards 1.2 that talks about decorum. And it says, the program attorney shall maintain dignified, polite, and respectful behavior at all times. And then, of course, professionalism. You do not yell at anyone, anywhere, anytime. That's unprofessional. You don't yell for someone to shut up, even if you're in the office. Now, what about Henry, you know, the attorney ad litem? Let's pick on him a little bit. How about any ethical problem that he has?
He did not represent his client's expressed wishes.
Right. So you got 4-1.2, again, objectives and scope of representation. He's not following his client's directive that Martin doesn't want to take the medication. And here you have Henry just saying, oh, well, I know he doesn't want it, but I think that he needs it. And, you know, quite frankly, did we see this occur with attorney ad litems? In particular, I bring up, like, residential placements. I mean, I've seen that before, where the attorney ad litem will say, oh, well, the child really doesn't want to go, but I think they need to go. You ever see that in your practice?
Yes.
Yep. Yes. Well, it's our duty to let attorneys, you know, our co-counsel, so to speak, that are representing children, know their ethical obligations. Is it our obligation to talk to them about that and say, hey, you know, you're really not representing the child right? And explain to them, or we just leave it up to them and let them commit all these ethical violations? What do y'all think?
We have a duty.
You have a duty to let the attorney ad litem know the rules of ethics, and that they've, you know, maybe it's the first time. Maybe they'll appreciate it. You know, you bringing it up because maybe it's the first time they've ever represented a child. How about your guys' obligation to seek the best interest of the child? Do you have to tell the court the child's wishes? Do you have an ethical obligation when you're representing to the court what's in the best interest of the child?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, I would say that you do. And you can always say that the guardian ad litem program believes that it's in the child's best interest to have this Medline consult, and then if so, and get consent from the Medline. If the Medline says it's okay, well, we're for the medication, even though, Judge, we want you to let you know that the child does not want to take the medication. Because you have to understand that most judges, they think that everyone in the proceeding is working to the best interest of the child. And it looks really strange when one's saying yes, the other's saying no, as far as what's in the child's best interest.
In that instance, would an attorney ad litem be best appointed to the child if they're of age to express those wishes?
Of course. Of course, because if you think about it, it kind of puts you all in a bind. Because if the child's wishes are different from the program's wishes, then you got a conflict there. So exactly right, and very good bringing up that point. That may be the time to say, and knowing that that issue comes up, you may just want to ask for an attorney ad litem on every case that where you have that potential conflict. Okay, let's move on. Lori told Audrey that she wanted Rita and Ronald to submit to a psychological evaluation from Ronald French. She knew that Dr. French would write an unfavorable evaluation regarding Rita and Ronald. Audrey knew that the judge granted her motions 100% of the time, also knew that a psychological evaluation of Rita and Ronald would probably not be needed at trial due to the other compelling evidence in the case and that the evaluations could delay the trial for approximately 3 months. Audrey did not agree with Lori's request for a psychological evaluation. However, Audrey did not want to cause a confrontation with Lori and requested court to order that Rita and Ronald submit to psychological evaluations before the adjudicatory hearing. Parents' attorneys objected to the request, stating the dependency petition did not allege that either parent suffered from a mental health condition. Audrey did not respond because she knew that she didn't have to. Both Sandy and Henry supported the request. The judge granted the request, ordered parents to submit to psychological evaluations by Dr. French. So, do we have an ethical issue with the fact that, hey, is there a legal basis for these parents to submit to psych evals? Is there an ethical issue there? Can anyone help me?
Yes, this is Susan. I think that that's a frivolous action, and those motions should be brought in good faith, and it doesn't seem that that's happening.
Okay. Now, is it frivolous, and how do you know?
Well, it says the petition.
Right, you have to look at the petition.
It has an alleged mental health condition.
Right, but could you make a good faith argument to the judge that, hey, there's substance abuse and domestic violence going on in this family, that these people need a psych eval? There's obviously a mental health issue. What do you think?
Yes.
Yeah, you may be able to. The problem here is that Audrey didn't think that the psych eval was needed. So that's a problem, right?
Evidence disappears all the time.
Because Audrey's got an ethical rule that requires her, under 4-3.2, to expedite litigation. Psych eval means significant delay, right? Well, that's what we got here. Then you do have to look at whether Rule 4-3.1 that says that you have to have a basis in fact or law for asking the court to do something. You know, that's regarding meritorious claims and defenses. And what you always do is that if you are second-guessing whether it's got merit, the motion, or the request, well, guess what? You need to be taking it up the chain of command and getting some other opinions or asking some other attorneys. Because, you can get in big trouble if you file anything frivolous. And the other thing is that no written motion. Did you all notice that? You all never bring up motions in court, do you, without putting it in writing? It's a pretty serious thing, right? A motion for a psychological evaluation. Are you obligated to put it in writing? Yes or no? Anybody? Well, let me ask this. Would anyone have prepared a written motion on this issue?
You would need a written motion to provide notice to all the parties because she knows that there's no allegations in the petition. So the parents, knowing, I would obviously, you know, automatically presume that the parents' attorneys would be objecting, and to give timely notice that you're going to be asking the judge for a psychological evaluation, it should be put in writing so you can provide appropriate notice to all parties in order to have an appropriate hearing for objections, and so the judge has something to rule on.
Excellent, excellent point. You know, we're getting back to competence, 4-1.1. You know, as far as competent representation, you know, you got to be, and when you look at it, professionalism also, you know, you have to give people due process. And I'm just telling you, heads up, you got, I'm sure, appellate attorneys on the phone right now that are going to be shaking their heads when I say this. But the big thing before the DCAs that kicks these cases back is due process issues. So you don't want to create one. And then as far as Audrey just sitting silent and really not answering, hey, there is no legal basis, not responding at all, I mean, that's not good. That's competence also, right? She should have spoke up and made a good faith argument if she felt that there was one. Then, also, we have 4-3.3, candor to the tribunal, right? And sub 3, an attorney cannot fail to disclose court legal authority known to the lawyer to be directly adverse to the position of the client. So was Audrey obligated to say, Judge, I know that there we didn't state any legal basis, but... the rule says that it has to, mental health has to be in controversy, and we understand that the other side doesn't think that we've put it in controversy, but we think that it is because we've alleged domestic violence and substance abuse, and the parents have denied those issues. What do y'all think about that? Did Audrey have to bring it up? What the law was?
Yes.
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 An attorney, in order to be competent in as far as candor, tribunal, and professionalism, right? You're doing a motion. You need to tell the judge the legal basis. I mean, that's bread and butter lawyering. So y'all have to do that. And then how about Henry, the attorney ad litem? Should he have supported the motion if one child wanted to go home, the other didn't? You know, we want to get Martin home, right, as far as from an attorney ad litem perspective. And here we're Henry saying, oh, it's okay for the parents to do a psychological evaluation. What do you all think about that? Anybody think that he has an obligation if his client wants to go home to object to any continuances? All right. Well, I would submit that he does. And Henry's got a conflict from this point on also, because one kid wants to go home and one doesn't really, so... Both clients conflict, and he's got to represent both in court. Okay. We'll move on. After the hearing, Audrey asked Lori to ask Mike about whether he engaged in domestic violence with Rita. Lori then spoke to Mike, who was not in the presence of his attorney. Audrey stood next to Lori while Lori spoke to Mike. Lori asked Mike whether he and Rita ever engaged in domestic violence. Mike said that Rita hit him several times when they were together. He related on one occasion Rita punched him while she was holding Sally. Okay, what's wrong with this picture? Can Audrey tell Lori, hey, go over there and go ask Mike these questions that I need to know? Is that okay? Or not?
No.
Okay, why isn't it?
He's represented by counsel.
Right, because this guy's represented by counsel. And rule dash four. 4-4.2 says communication with person represented by counsel that that you cannot communicate regarding the substance of a case, and you could argue that Audrey's doing it through Lori. How about Audrey just standing there? Is that communication?
I was going to say it would appear that it was if she's standing right beside Lori when she's talking to him.
Yeah, you can't avoid ethical issues just by, you know, logistics. I mean, it seems like there was a communication going on there. Okay, we'll move on. The court held a status hearing on September 28, 2009 and determined the status of the psychological evaluation. So Audrey pointed out to the court that Gina never gave the parents a referral to the evaluation. Court ordered that Gina immediately provide referrals to the parents for the evaluations. At another status conference on October 5, 2009, Audrey advised court that the evaluations had not taken place because Gina still had not received approval from her director for funds for the evaluation. Without submitting a written motion, Audrey requests court enter an order to show cause to Gina for failure to obtain psychological evaluations on parents. Court granted order to show cause, set the order to show cause for October 12, 2009. Audrey never prepared a proposed order to show cause. So what do we got here? Was that okay for Audrey to ask for an order to show cause?
No.
Yes or no?
No.
And why not?
Wasn't proper notice.
Right. There was a notice that we got competence 4-1.1 where should have put someone on notice for that. Should have had a written motion, of course. And remember y'all's standards. And when I was reviewing it, the standard of practice, 2.7.2, and failure, it says in the second paragraph, if the failure of another party comply with a court order affects the best interest of the child, the program attorney shall contact counsel for the offending party, provide notice of violation, and notice of guardian items program intent to seek enforcement and order, and to determine whether to file a motion and compel compliance, and consult with supervising attorney. So Audrey didn't do any of this stuff. And then the order to show cause, you know, there's a specific process for that, filing a motion and having allegations and so forth, needs to learn, and this may be a frivolous request.
Frivolous
question, 4-3.1.
This is Wanda Davis from the Sixth Circuit. Let me ask you, parents are represented by counsel. How does waiver affect what you're telling us? Waiver of notice.
If the parents notice, but the department's not waiving notice. If I'm representing the department and you're bringing this up, I'm going to say no notice. No motion. Let's set it for another day.
Right. And I can understand that. But when the department participates in the argument of whether there should be a order to show cause.
I see. Well, I seem to think that you really can't. I understand how you could argue that there's a waiver, but it's really not the best way to practice. Bottom line is that I threw this stuff in the scenarios to show that you got to give people notice. Process issues are coming up with the DAs every single day. So you need to cover yourself, and also it's professional to do so. So thanks a lot for bringing up that point. And then not preparing the order to show cause, again, competence. Let's move on. Rita and Ronald completed psychological evaluations on October 12, 2009. Same day, the court held the order to show cause hearing. Audrey requested the court find Gina in contempt for violating court order. Sandy objected, stating the original order in the psychological evaluation did not direct Gina to provide referrals to the parents, did not order the CBC to pay for the evaluations. Sandy further argued that there was no written order to show cause. Although Audrey knew Sandy's position was correct, Audrey argued that Gina violated the spirit of order. The judge found Gina in contempt but decided not to impose a sanction since the parents had completed the psychological evaluations. So, was there a problem that there was no order to show cause and that It was just all based order tennis.
Yes.
Okay, so we're getting back to confidence, right? 4-1.1. And then how about the candor with the tribunal? You know, letting the court know about the legal basis. I mean, was there a good faith basis? And we also meritorious claims and defenses, 4-3.1, saying that there was a violation of spirit of order. Problem with that? Is there a problem with saying, oh, well, Judge, they violated the spirit of order. We know that there was nothing in writing or that it didn't say that.
I've never heard such an argument.
Okay, well, you did now. So is there a problem? Bottom line is, there is a problem. You can't just argue something, you know, it's a good faith argument. And just saying the spirit, I don't find that to be in good faith. All right, we'll move on. Dr. French did not complete the written report until December 15, 2009. Surprisingly, Dr. French did not indicate that Rita Ronald suffered from any mental health disorder, recommended Rita Ronald engage in some family counseling. Court sets the adjudicatory hearing for January 13, 2010. Preparation for trial. Audrey visited Sally Martin at Foster Homes, reviewed French's testimony for adjudicatory hearing. Audrey did not provide advance notice to any of the other attorneys that she would be speaking to the children. Audrey told the children she was on their side. She would always act in their best interest. Audrey also told children to tell the truth. Martin told Audrey with his domestic violence between his mother and Ronald. However, he said that he would lie to court if he was asked whether he ever witnessed any domestic violence. Martin said that he wanted to go home. Audrey told Martin that if he lied, judge would put him in jail. Sally said that he witnessed domestic violence and that she was scared to go home. Audrey told Sandy that she had prepared the children for both the adjudicatory hearing and for the adjudicatory hearing and that Sandy did not need to speak with the children. Henry spoke to both the children before the adjudicatory hearing and obtained similar statements. Okay, problem. Is there a problem with Audrey talking to these kids?
Yes.
Yeah, they're represented by counsel. 4-4.2, communication with persons represented by counsel. Can't do that without talking to Henry first. Did Audrey make any misleading statements to the attorney, to the children, to have them believe that she was their attorney? How about that she...
Yeah, that she was on their side.
That she was on their side. So, you know, Audrey really needed to make sure that the children understood that she was not their attorney. And then, how about the fact that Martin says he's going to lie? What's Audrey's duty regarding that? Any at this time, besides telling him not to lie? What do you think? I would say probably no duty, but she probably wants to tell the other attorneys about it. Let's move on. Audrey did some investigation and found a year-old injunction petition that Rita filed against Ronald, indicating Ronald had beaten her in the presence of the children. She forgot to make a copy for all other attorneys in the case. Is there a problem with that?
Yes.
Getting something and not providing it to the other side. What's the problem?
Not enough notice to the other side.
How about the fact that this stuff is in a court file somewhere and the parents' attorneys could have got in themselves? No? Okay. Rule 4-3.4A. A lawyer shall not unlawfully obstruct another party's access to evidence or unlawfully conceal relevant documents. Now, the law says that basically there's open discovery in these proceedings, and if Audrey was using it, she should have given it to the other side. All right, next. At the adjudicatory hearing on January 13, 2010, Sandy took testimony from Rita. Rita indicated that there was only one domestic violence between herself and Ronald. In cross-exam, Audrey confronted Rita with the... Rita's attorney objected, stated he never received a copy of the petition for injunction. Audrey responds, she never received a discovery request from any party in the case. Judge overrules the objection. Rita continues to deny that there was ever more than one domestic violence incident, said she filed an injunction against Ronald because she was mad that he was cheating on her. Audrey did not offer the petition in the evidence. Rita also testified that Mike beat her in the presence of the children 3 years ago. So was there a problem with Audrey saying, they didn't give me a discovery request, so I didn't need to give it to them? Yes or no?
Yes, unless there was some other agreement.
What's that? Someone says that there's a problem. Oh, I never received a discovery request. I would say, as a general rule, you need to give any evidence that you're going to use to the other side, whether you got a discovery request or not. We don't hide behind the rules of procedure so that we cannot be professional. All right. Sandy also took testimony of Ronald, Mike, Sally, and Martin. Ronald admitted to one incident of domestic violence. He advised that he and Rita were no longer living together, not seeing each other in 4 months. Mike denied committing any domestic violence, stated Rita would not let him see Martin. Sally testified regarding abuse from Martin, said that Rita and Ronald failed to protect her from Martin, and that she had witnessed domestic violence between Rita and Ronald. Martin denied that he saw any domestic violence in the home. Audrey asked Martin on cross-exam whether he told her in the past that he would lie about seeing any domestic violence. He denied ever saying he would lie. In response to Martin's denial, Audrey asked to approach a bench with the other attorneys. She asked the judge for a recess, meet with the judge in chambers, and she told the judge that Martin had admitted that he witnessed domestic violence and indicated he would lie about it in court because he wanted to return to his mother. The parents' attorneys all objected to Audrey's statements. Judge responded that all he could do was remind Martin to tell the truth and advise Martin consequences of committing perjury. Was there a problem? Look at 4-3.3, Candor Towards Tribunal.
And David, real quick, I'm just going to interrupt, and we're not done yet, so please do not, it's 1 o'clock, please do not all start hanging up. The beeps are very disruptive. We have the line till 1:30. If you have to go to court, please put your phone just down on mute and ask someone to come back and hang it up, okay? Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Mary Kay. Sorry about running late. Okay, so candor towards the tribunal. That a lawyer cannot permit a witness to offer testimony that the lawyer knows to be false. Okay, anyone have a problem with what Audrey did? Okay, I'm not... You know, the thing to get around this, with what Audrey did, even though it's really strange, Audrey's not offering the evidence. Sandy, the DCF attorney, is. So... and I would say that it's proper to meet in chambers. But it's really strange what she did. And the meeting should be on the record. The trial then resumes. The court advised Martin regarding need to tell the truth, consequences for committing perjury, continue to testify, never witness domestic violence. Then Sandy and Audrey did a compelling closing argument. Attorney for the parents made a closing argument. In his closing, Henry requested that both children be adjudicated dependent. However, none of the attorneys advised the court that the case law in the Second District Court of Appeal held that there were no grounds for dependency adjudication if there was only one incident of domestic violence without proof that the children suffered from emotional harm or proof that there was a current threat of further. The judge granted the dependency petition and scheduled a disposition hearing. Is there a problem with the attorneys failing to bring up the case law in the second DCA to the court? Yes or no?
Yes, you have to tell the court what the case law is.
Right. 4-3.3, you have to tell the court the legal authority. And then competence. You don't do a closing argument without bringing up law. I mean, that's just wrong. You can have an argument that it doesn't apply, but you have to bring it up. At the disposition and judicial review hearing, on February 17, 2010, Lori told Audrey outside the courtroom that all the parents should complete domestic violence evaluations and anger management courses. Audrey knew that the anger management course was probably unnecessary. Audrey decided to let Lori make the anger management course, herself. Audrey stood silent while Lori made a recommendation to the court. Parents' attorney objected to the anger management course. The judge asked Lori the reason for the anger management course. Lori responded that parents seemed very angry in court. Judge saw Audrey roll her eyes and then denied Lori's recommendation. Court ordered that Gina provide referrals to the parents immediately. Judge accepts case plan, requires parents to complete parenting courses and domestic violence course. The judge formally placed the children in foster care. Is there an ethical problem with Audrey just sitting there and let Lori make the request? Again, yes, of course. You guys are the litigators. You're supposed to be a zealous advocate. If you can't make a good faith objection, what the client wants, you need to do it outside the courtroom as far as resolving any disputes and bring it up the chain of command. 4-3.1, all your claims and defenses have to be meritorious, and there was no basis for the anger management. Okay, at the next judicial review on August 16, 2010, Sandy advised the court that the parents had not substantially complied with the case plan, and that it was her understanding that Gina had not provided referrals to their parents for parenting and domestic violence. So there was a new caseworker. You ever have that happen? Bill Owens assigned to the case who had not known about the judge's prior order. The judge ordered Bill to provide the referrals to the parents immediately. Then at the status in September, Audrey says again that Bill had not provided parents with referrals, not secured funding to pay for the parents' courses. Responded, Sandy responds the parents were working and the CBC was not obligated to pay for the courses. Judge orders CBC to pay for the parents' courses. At the status hearing on October 13th, Audrey advised that Bill provided referrals, CBC still hadn't paid. Sandy advised that parents never provided budgets to the CBC to get approval for funding. Again, the court ordered CBC to pay for the courses. CBC eventually paid for the courses. Is there a problem with Audrey just sitting there August, September, October, just going in court and saying, they didn't do it? Is there a problem?
Yes.
Okay, shouldn't Audrey have brought up the issue to Sandy way back in August and had a staffing or something to resolve the issue?
Yes.
You can't just sit there. I know that it's great, you know, going for blood, but the thing is that you're going for blood at the child's expense. Anything that's wrong with the case that is not in the best interest of the child, you should be able to resolve outside the courtroom and not bring it in. Judges think that it's really weird us, you know, DCF, guardian ad litem, attorney ad litem, saying different things. Try and get all on one page. Try and get the issues resolved without bringing it up in court. 4-1.1, you got competence. Okay. And then also just wanted to make, you never roll your eyes when your client's talking. You know, that's a definite no-no. And then also, you have an obligation under 4-3.2 to expedite litigation. And Audrey was just letting this case linger. Then another status hearing, November, argues that the parents just begun their courses. That Audrey says DCF needs to file a TPR petition because this kid's been in out-of-home care 14 months. And the attorneys and Sandy object to the request. Judge orders the department file the petition within 30 days. Sandy files for a motion of rehearing saying no grounds for filing. So is there a problem with Audrey bringing this up and asking that DCF file a petition? Yes, there's no grounds. So You can't avoid not filing a frivolous petition just because you're going to have someone else do it. Okay, that's Rule 4-3.1. Then on November 23rd, court hears a motion for a rehearing. Says, I can't file this petition in good faith. Everyone's in agreement except Audrey. And she says, I'm filing the petition. Then everyone leaves the courtroom except for Audrey and the judge. Audrey then says to the judge, boy, this family's really messed up. These kids don't have a chance. Judge smiles and doesn't respond. Is there a problem with Audrey proceeding with the petition?
Yes. Yes, if there's no grounds.
No grounds? There you go. And also, notice the irony here. Here, Audrey is showing that these parents hadn't gotten referrals, had not got the state to pay for the courses. She's saying that month after month, and then she turns around and says, we need to get these kids TPR'd. So there's a professionalism and ethical problem as far as expediting litigation. Then how about the conversation with Audrey and the judge? Was that a
ex parte
communication with the judge that violates 4-3.5B?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. Very good. I mean, the thing is that I always think, you know, before I became an attorney, we all watched Night Court. You remember that? Where everyone was hanging out, friends, eating and everything together with the judge and the bailiff and the attorneys, and they were all buddy-buddy. Well, the thing is that can happen, but the thing is that you still can't talk about the case. We still have to be professional. We still have to follow the rules. Okay. Let's just talk about some themes. If there are any disagreements with anyone in the process, resolve them using the chain of command. If someone's not doing their job, please bring it up behind the scenes because that's in the best interest of the child. And then lastly, please take a look at your ethical rules again, and y'all have some excellent, excellent standards of practice for to be an attorney for the Guardian Ad Litem program and standards of operation. Does anyone have any issues they want to bring up? All right, well, hearing nothing further, thank you very much for giving me this opportunity to do this training for you. I had a great time. Y'all participated very well and came up with all the right answers. Thank you so much.